From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today marks the 50th year the world celebrates Earth Day. This Friday, April 24th, is National Arbor Day. As people self-isolate, vehicle traffic has lessened, parks have quieter days, and some environmental essayists suggest the Earth is breathing a sigh of relief. The BBC reports a pride of lions has taken to napping on a road in a South African national park. A herd of Kashmiri goats runs around a Welsh town eating hedges and snacking on greens in residential window boxes. In California's Yosemite Park, Reuters reports that bears and coyotes now walk in areas usually populated by people. The rats in New Orleans are almost certainly wondering, says the New York Times, where the usual French Quarter crowds and their trash have gone. In New Hanover County, officials tell us the gardens at the Arboretum are flourishing, perhaps enjoying the break from all that foot traffic. And while people are mandated to generally stay home and self-isolate, landscaping and spring planting continues. Today, we're going to find out how to undertake spring gardening safely, given the COVID-19 restrictions. We'll also learn which varieties are best suited for planting right now, and we'll find out how to better care for our existing trees, shrubs, and flowering plants. And for those ready to tackle growing their own produce, we'll get some guidance and find out why a large backyard or even garden space is not necessary. Joining me now, Lloyd Singleton. He's director for the North Carolina Cooperative Extension New Hanover County Center at the Arboretum. Lloyd Singleton, welcome to Coastline.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
And I'm also very glad to have Tom Erickson, co-owner of the Transplanted Garden, a garden supply store in Wilmington on South 16th Street. Tom Erickson, welcome back to Coastline.
Thank you. It's always great to be with you.
Great to have both of you here. And I should point out that the Transplanted Garden is a longtime underwriter of WHQR. And we're inviting you to join the conversation during this live Wednesday discussion. What questions do you have about planting this spring? What are the plants that always give you trouble? What do you love? What do you want to try this year? Email us during the live Wednesday discussion at coastline@whqr.org. And Tom, I want to deal first with your unusual decision to close the Transplanted Garden early because of COVID-19. You do fall into the category of essential businesses, so legally you could have stayed open. And I know that you've reopened and businesses by appointment only, but tell us why you decided to do that. What was it like at your store?
Well, the last 4 days that we were open before the governor asked everybody to shelter in place and to basically shut down everything else, we had over 600 credit card transactions in 4 days. And that's a lot of people, you know, at you. I mean, we were running two credit card machines. And, I mean, at that point, nobody was wearing masks or gloves. Or, you know, a few people would come in, but they were, you know, very few. And it just got a little overwhelming, and with seeing everything that's going on, that was going on at that point in New York City, and seeing everything, I've got family that lives in Barcelona. They've been there for 30-something years. It just wasn't feeling safe. And so we decided to shut down for a couple of weeks to try to figure out what we could do, and just to make sure we were all safe, so that we could come up with a way to try to control the number of people in our faces at any one point. Typically, this is our absolute busiest time of the entire year. And to shut down right now seemed suicidal, but it also seemed suicidal to stay open at the rate everything was spreading. And so we did that, and now we've come up where we've turned our phones off because the phones are just ringing nonstop. But we've turned our phones off, and we've basically told everybody on our outgoing message that if you need to get a hold of us, if you want to set up an appointment, to email us, and then we will set up a time so that we can kind of stagger everybody and try to limit spacing. We've shut the parking lot down. We're using that so we can get people to, you know, find things a little easier than they would if they were all around the nursery. But it also, because we're trying to limit everybody to about 30 minutes, so that it would make it faster for people to find things.
And you're also requiring people to come to your store, like if they make an appointment to come, you're requiring they have gloves and a mask?
Right. And I mean, it can be just simply garden gloves. I mean, it doesn't have to be surgical grade anything. I mean, if you've got a bandana over your face, if you've got a mask, that's fine. I mean, we're not looking for respirators. We're just trying to, you know, have some protection for everybody, our staff included, most especially. I mean, we're all nervous about, you know, with so many people coming to us that, you know, and they've seen other people. There was one doctor that I saw on a news program somewhere and said that, you're not just seeing me, you're seeing everybody I've seen before you today. I mean,
right.
That's, I mean, where it all comes from. And I mean, to drive by these big box stores and see people just all over the place, I mean, that's frightening. I mean, there's just so many people and nobody's distancing, nobody's wearing masks. And, you know, it just was pretty disturbing. I mean, I've seen photos of what's happening in Europe with the shutting down there. I mean, my brother-in-law there can only go out to the grocery store, can go out to the doctor, or they can go out and walk the dog, and that's it. I mean, the drugstore being included. I mean, those are the only things that are open. And he was home for 2 weeks before going to the grocery store for the first time, and he got there, and they handed him a mask and a pair of rubber gloves to use while he was there. And, right. I mean, they're just not fooling around.
There's been a learning curve here in North Carolina in terms of how businesses that are staying open can do it in a safe way. And I want to make sure as we get into ideas for spring planting and ideas for gardening and better care of all of these plants, that we're not encouraging people to rush out and, you know, run to big box stores and engage in this in a way that isn't safe. So Lloyd Singleton of the North Carolina Cooperative Extension, what are some of the ways you would suggest for people to engage in spring planting and stay safe at the same time?
Well, I'd say if any of the plant material you can buy could be provided by a nursery that would offer curbside service, that's a great way to reduce your risk of exposure. I think also when you are in a nursery shopping or one of the big box stores, make sure you do socially distance. And then if you want seeds, I recommend doing seeds by mail order. I mean, seed catalogs that are available online can ship directly to you. Now, a lot of them have had a lot of business and are, in some cases, not even taking new customers. But there are going to be some mail order seed companies that are still offering that opportunity.
And we'll get into what people can plant for food in a little while. But first, what would you suggest for planting just for design and color and excitement, Tom Erickson?
Well, right now, I mean, it's still very cool. It's odd. We were warmer back in February than we are now. I mean, we have pentas out there. We have angelonias. I mean, we have a number of the typical very easy, you know, all summer long flowers. Vincas, we've got just a handful of those, and they work very well in the hot, dry conditions of our summers here, including in the humidity. Those are starting to trickle in. Zinnias haven't quite come out yet, but those will be around soon. Those are all some of the real, you know, strong stalwarts of the garden for spring plantings to get us through the summer. We've got a lot of other plants for containers and things like that. We've got, like I said, a good selection of tomatoes and a lot of herbs. I mean, it's easy to do with those in containers as well as in the ground. But, I mean, we're coming on with a lot of different things for, you know, the typical color for around our area for this time of the year. And those are just, we've got a lot of perennials, so things will come back year after year. Just make sure you're adding compost and fertilizing as you're doing all this.
Right. Lloyd Singleton, What would you advise planting right now? You're coming at this from a slightly different perspective.
Well, I'm really encouraging people to use the time outdoors to grow something to eat. I mean, I think growing your own food is a really rewarding task. And there's a lot of herbs that you can do very easily, for instance, in small containers that would provide you some great culinary additions all summer long. If you want to grow in ground, if you want to have a garden or a larger container, you can do any number of the vegetable crops. Highly recommend doing cherry tomatoes. A real small variety of tomato is typically easy to grow. The larger ones are more challenging. So if you're a beginning gardener, don't start with something that's going to be a struggle for you, but start with something easy. Radishes are super easy for kids, and they're quick, and give that reward very, very easily. Sunflowers, great to seed right now and have that bloom in the summertime. Lots of different options with vegetables and herbs that you can grow this time of year. This is a great month to plant.
We have a question from our good friend Mary. She says, I love basil. Tried to grow it from seed this year. Sowed the seeds 3 weeks ago. No luck. So have bought plants to grow. Is it ever possible to grow basil from seeds in the ground with slightly sandy but amended soil? Could I try again this year?
I think you could. I think warm soil is going to be a real key to the germination. And so if it was outside, you know, and we had some colder days, that could have really stunted the growth or prohibited it. Also, the age of the seed is very important, so make sure that you are starting with fresh basil seed. But it's also good for the nursery industry to buy plants, a little more foolproof.
You're listening to Coastline. It's our spring planting show. During the pandemic, how can people garden safely, perhaps even consider growing their own food? Lloyd Singleton of the North Carolina Cooperative Extension and Tom Erickson of the Transplanted Garden are here. Well, they're not here. They're on the phone. And they're answering your questions. And when we come back from this break, we'll hear from some more listeners. You can ask your own question by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. It's time for spring planting, and with the COVID-19 restrictions in place and so many people not going to work in North Carolina, it's a perfect time to refresh the garden or try growing your own food, even if you have very little space to garden or no backyard. Tom Erickson of the Transplanted Garden in downtown Wilmington is with us today, along with Lloyd Singleton, director of the North Carolina Cooperative Extension New Hanover County Center at the Arboretum. If you'd like to ask your own question during this live Wednesday discussion on Earth Day, send us an email at coastline@whqr.org. And a reminder, phone lines are not open while we're broadcasting from a home studio. And I want to start with this question from Nick. He writes, my father put in some fig trees a few years ago, and they don't seem to be doing that well. They're still fairly small and don't produce figs. Any fertilizer or soil addendums I can use to boost growth rate? They're still under 1.5 feet tall after 6 years, and they get good sunlight. So I don't know if this is a Tom or a Lloyd question.
I'll let Lloyd take that one. I mean, I would assume it probably need fertilizer.
Right. Lloyd, what kind of fertilizer or food would you suggest?
Well, we want to make sure that you have a balanced fertilizer. We want to make sure there's something where the three numbers are in a good ratio. For instance, if you have a turf fertilizer, it very likely has a very high nitrogen rate, which is the first number. And if you do that on something like a fruit tree, it's going to promote a lot of leafy growth and not the fruiting. So you probably want to do something in a ratio of a maximum of 3-1-2 as far as the ratio of the three numbers. But something balanced like a 10-10-10 would be a good synthetic fertilizer. But I'm also a big proponent of amending the soil with compost. And you want to do that in the root zone of the tree because, frankly, we have a lot of dead soil and we want to do things we can to improve the microbiome biology of the soil, and that will help the plant be healthier. So amending, kind of top dressing the root zone of the fig with a good compost product is a good first step.
So going back to the fertilizer question, can you just talk a little bit about the different types of fertilizer? And I mean, you said if you use the wrong fertilizer on a fruit tree, it can leaf instead of fruit. But what are the other differences between a fertilizer for, say, hydrangeas versus a lawn? And well, how can people get this straight?
It's quite a science, and I think it's very important to read the label of the fertilizer and see what crop it's recommended for. Something like a hydrangea is going to need more acidified soil, and so you're going to basically find a lot of the components in the nutrition are sulfur-based because that helps with the soil acidification. And turf fertilizer is going to be generally geared more toward the nitrogen because that's the element that the grass needs mostly. It's really a big, big question, and we are always there as our plant clinic, staffing with master gardeners to assist any residents with specific recommendations of fertilizer for the crop they're growing.
Now, if I don't have an established landscaping plan, but I do have space, a backyard, should I develop a landscaping plan, or can I just sort of randomly add things that I like as I go? Tom Erickson.
Well, it can be done both ways, but it's always nice to have some ideas to where you're going to end up. And it can just be a simple rough sketch. It doesn't have to be, you know, real super fine detail. I mean, just locating trees where you might need shade, locating evergreens where you'd want some screening from the neighbors behind you that, as we were talking earlier, have just all of a sudden popped up behind you. Just some of the big picture kinds of things. You know, and if you want a little bit of lawn for animals to run around on or children, you know, kind of program some of those things in. If you want a vegetable garden, I mean, they're not always the prettiest thing, especially midsummer around here. You know, set that off to the side somewhere. Make sure it's got good air circulation and some good sunshine. I would kind of start with just some of the basic things. I mean, if you want to add a pond, kind of, you know, just a small little decorative pond, see where that might work into, and, you know, check the sun situations. But that's where I'd probably start, and then kind of make a list of some of the things that you do like, maybe some colors that you particularly prefer, and, you know, so you have that kind of just some notes when you're out shopping, so you have an idea as to what it is you're headed towards. And just going back quickly to that fig tree, I mean, that you might check the drainage on that. I mean, if it's in an area that's extremely wet, that could be really holding it back. But, I mean, if it's in good soil with sun and it's been fed, I don't know why else it would be still 18 inches tall after 6 years. But I'd start with, you know, just some sort of a general plan so you don't end up with a pile of plants that you don't know where to put at, you know, put place into the garden when you get home.
You're listening to Coastline. It's our spring gardening show, and we have two experts to answer your questions during this live Wednesday discussion. Tom Erickson is co-owner of The Transplanted Garden, a garden supply store in downtown Wilmington, and a longtime underwriter of WHQR. Lloyd Singleton is director of the North Carolina Cooperative Extension, New Hanover County Center at the Arboretum. If you would like to ask a question or just tell us what you're doing with your garden this year, you can send an email to coastline@whqr.org. And Christian writes, "Hi, loving this show. My 3 and 4-year-old girls and I have spent the morning transplanting germinated seeds, Gerber daisies from last year, and veggies a neighbor gave us. It's been pretty great." And then Christian says, "Question for Tom. I have an out of control, over 6 foot tall and wide white spirea. It's probably 20 years old and hasn't been touched in over 5. May I cut it to the ground now? If not, how do I prune it and when? It's finished blooming."
Yeah, I mean, this is the perfect time for that. Anything that's already bloomed this this season. Can be trimmed as much as you need to. I would say probably you may not want to cut the entire thing back to the ground, but try to cut the older stems way down to rejuvenate it, and then maybe leave some of the other stems maybe a third of the original height. And then that way it'll open up the air circulation within the plant as well, which will certainly help it. But by getting that older wood out of there, it'll help some of the newer shoots that are coming up, give them some more space and breathing room. But like I said, this time of year, things like camellias can be pruned. They've now finished blooming for the most part. There's still a few blooms here and there on a couple of the later varieties. But the fall bloomers and then the spring bloomers, they all start budding up in June. You won't necessarily see it so much, but if you wait too long before pruning those, you're going to run into problems where you're not going to have very many flower buds if you do it too late in the season.
Okay, and Suzanne writes, is there a good alternative to grass for ground cover that likes sun and sandy soil? Lloyd Singleton.
Oh, sure. I have been experimenting a little bit with a ground cover called micro clover. It's a clover that has been hybridized to remain short and seems to love the sandy soil and good full sun. It actually stayed fairly green all winter long, too. There's also some native potential ground covers. Fog fruit, frog fruit, or Phyla nodiflora is one, and we can also grow Mimosa strigulosa here. There's plenty of opportunities to do alternative ground covers. The other thing I love to say about lawns is monocultures are not mandated by law. You know, we can allow a mixture of turf grasses and what some may consider weeds together as a diverse ground cover, keep it mowed, and it actually is better for the environment and doesn't require as many inputs to try to keep it just one type of grass.
Okay, for those who haven't heard the term before, what do you mean when you say monoculture?
Well, for instance, we say I have a zoysia lawn or I have a centipede lawn. That means that's the only kind of plant that you're allowing to grow in that area. And that's not really the way nature does things. So we're actually kind of battling nature constantly to keep it as one monoculture.
Okay. And I want to go back to this idea of pruning because this is also, it can be tricky. For instance, if you prune at the wrong time, you can wind up cutting off buds that might not be visible to the eye. Is that right? I mean, how do we know when we really should be pruning our plants? Are these all different schedules? For instance, azaleas versus hydrangeas? Tom Erickson?
Yeah, hydrangeas, that's one that always causes a lot of confusion. People want to take in the fall and cut them back so that they don't look at the sticks all winter. And that's what I hear. And by cutting hydrangeas, the mop heads, the lace caps, you know, the great big typical hydrangeas, the blues and the pinks and the whites that you see in people's gardens. If you cut those back in the fall to the ground or in the winter or even early spring, all your flower buds are removed. The flower buds are at the top third of the stems that were grown last year. So the only really good time you can prune hydrangeas without removing a lot of the flower buds is like midsummer, right after they're finished blooming. As they're fading, you can go in and thin out, again, like I'm saying with the spirea, the oldest stems, take those to the ground, cut some of the other ones back maybe halfway to try to reduce the height and the width of them. And then that way it gives them enough time to continue growing through the second and late half of the summer and early fall so that you can produce flower buds. But then there's exceptions to that because there's also the paniculata, the limelight-type hydrangeas with the big cone-shaped flowers. Those will bloom on new wood so that they can be pruned early in the spring or in the winter to reduce the size, and then they still bloom because they're blooming on the tips of the new growth. So it can get a little tricky, but as long as you kind of work with the plant in knowing when it blooms. Like I said, the early spring bloomers, the camellias, the spireas that have finished, The azaleas are now done, so those can all be pruned. And I like to prune by hand rather than making meatballs out of things that shouldn't be turned into meatballs. It's just, you know, it's a lot more aesthetically pleasing. But, you know, if it blooms later.
What do you mean by making a meatball, Tom? Paint the picture for us.
I mean, people like to take, I've seen the landscapers, or as I call them, landscrapers, take things like boxwoods or firepower nandina and try to turn them into round circles of all different shapes, sizes, so none of them match. You know, it works great for a boxwood hedge or, to, you know, something a little more formal, but they do a little bit too much over pruning on the wrong plants with the hedge clippers. And it's just, you know, if you drive by, you know, commercial buildings, you know, you see all these little globs and orbs of different sizes and shapes, and, you know, none of them really match. A hedge should be the same size all the way through if that's the purpose, but if you're going to prune it into individual shrubs, they should match, and it's better to do by hand.
So we want to avoid making meatballs. We don't want to commit crepe murder, and we're going to talk about tree suffocation in a minute. It's our spring gardening show. You're listening to Coastline. We have two experts answering your questions during this live Wednesday discussion. If you would like to ask a question of Lloyd Singleton, director of the North Carolina Cooperative Extension, New Hanover County at the Arboretum, you can send an email to coastline@whqr.org. You also just heard Tom Erickson, co-owner of the Transplanted Garden, a garden supply store in downtown Wilmington. They are both answering your questions on this Wednesday. And Mary asks again another good question. She says, I grew tons of kale from seed last fall, started harvesting in October, and we are still harvesting and eating it today. It still tastes good, she says, and it keeps growing. That's amazing. Is it okay to eat this old/new kale? I would hate to pull it up. Lloyd Singleton, what would you say?
Absolutely. And kale is one of those amazing plants that will overwinter here and continue to producing. So a fall planting of some of those leafy greens, kale, collard, Swiss chard, et cetera, does really well, and you can harvest all winter long, and then into the spring. Now, eventually, the kale will give up the ghost as it gets too hot, probably by July. It may tend to bolt and go to seed, and that's when you need to go ahead and pull it up or let it reseed and have more kale next fall.
So you could do that. You could just leave it there, and it'll come back.
Exactly. One of the techniques that's kind of a good standard is called cropping, where you actually harvest only the lower leaves of some of those plants. You don't harvest the whole plant at one time, and that lets it continue to produce for many, many months.
Jessica writes, I'm looking at starting my first garden in raised beds soon. I've been looking at the square foot gardening method. I was wondering if there were any tips to follow with this method. Also, is it possible to plant colder nature plants like spinach or lettuce in a partially shaded area so it's cooler, getting 4 to 5 hours of sun instead of 8 to 9 hours? Lloyd Singleton?
Yes, actually, the leafy greens will thrive in a shadier environment, whereas something like a squash or a tomato is going to need more like 6+ full hours of sun. But the lettuce and spinach, and you will kind of extend the growing season by having it in shade. As far as tips on a raised bed garden, keep in mind that that will require more irrigation. We need to make sure that that you use water that's appropriate for a garden and brings rain barrels up for question, by the way, because the Soil and Water Conservation District here locally offers rain barrels for sale every month. And that's a good way to collect rainwater, which is not chlorinated. Therefore, it's a good source of water, irrigation water, for your raised beds. The other tip would be to make sure that you've amended your soil with plenty of compost, plenty of organic matter, because that's really going to help fight nematodes and some of the other problems you might have in vegetable gardens that don't have a good organic matter content.
Jorge writes, unlike the previous question about fig trees, I have a different problem. My fig tree is doing great. It's about 5 feet high. It's been bearing fruit for 3 years. My problem, he says, is the birds are very fond of the figs. While I don't mind sharing some of my harvest with my avian visitors, rather than eating the entire fruit, they seem to be taking a few beakfuls out of each fig. Any suggestions on how to handle the bird problem? And is it possible the previous fig question may have been a particular fig variety that doesn't thrive in our particular climate? And he says, enjoying the show, getting solace from my garden. Thanks so much for that, Jorge. What's the answer to that? What do you do about the birds taking little beakfuls from each fig?
Well, the only alternative would be really to cage the plant. I mean, to build a frame over it that could be maybe taken down seasonally, you know, just put up when the fruit is getting closer to ripening, and using netting, but you're going to have to get it all the way down to the ground, because if they find one little spot, they'll get in there, and if the birds are small enough, you know, they may be able to squeeze through the netting too. So, I mean, you're going to need to use something that's a fairly tight mesh on that to keep them away.
Lillian writes, "You are so right about the benefits of even a rough sketch to plan a garden. I designed and put in the native pollinator garden at Castle Branches Community Garden, and the planning stage was a huge help later on," she says. Question, our 30-plot community garden is full sun and sandy soil. We don't do well with most viney fruits and vegetables. What are your top three suggestions for viney fruits and vegetables for beginners? And
well,
Lloyd Singleton will... I'll tell you what, let's answer that when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline. It's the Spring Gardening Show on this Wednesday, April 22nd. You can ask a question of our experts today or tell us how you're gardening and staying safe during the stay-at-home order. Our email address is coastline@whqr.org. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, more from listeners. It's also the last segment, so you have just a few minutes left to get your own question or comment in during this live Wednesday discussion. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today we're learning about spring planting, the best plants to choose for this area, how to care for them, and we're going to get to how the region could do a better job caring for its trees. Tom Erickson of the Transplanted Garden and Lloyd Singleton, director of the North Carolina Cooperative Extension New Hanover County Center at the Arboretum, they're both with us today by phone and answering your questions. What are you planting right now? Which plants do you struggle with each year? Tell us about it or ask a question during the live discussion on this Wednesday by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. This is the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question or comment in. And Lloyd Singleton, just before we went to break, Lillian had asked about the top three suggestions for viney fruits and vegetables for beginners in full sun and sandy soil.
So the three tips would be trellis, trellis, and trellis. You need to get that viney vegetable up off the soil and give some sort of structure for it to climb up on. Even squashes will do very well when trellised up on top of something, whether it's a fence or bamboo poles or something that you create that way. Tomatoes, beans, they're all going to love to be trellised and up off the ground.
I want to read a Facebook comment that we got from Frank, which is fun. Frank writes, "We're sheltering in place in London and have no garden, but the potatoes are sprouting nicely in the cupboard. However, my mate up the road has just discovered she has three-cornered leek snowbells growing in her garden and is about to make pesto from them. Clearly, we are all about eating in London." Thanks for that. Joanne writes, "What are humane ways to keep squirrels from eating my garden?"
I don't have an answer for that.
Well, if you're lucky enough, we have here at the store on 16th Street, we had a red-tailed hawk move in across the street and is nesting in a pine tree, and they have two or three hatchings a year. And we used to have squirrels running amok all over the place here, so we're very lucky that we don't have the problem we used to. I've still got one at home. I did have a hawk move in there three winters ago now, and the squirrel population went from, you know, out of control to much better, but there's still a few of them running around. It's about the only thing you can do.
Yeah. And Fritzy writes, I have a dogwood that is over 25 years old. Its blooms have become the size of dimes and parts are dying. Folks tell me that it has lived its lifespan, but it is putting out new growth towards the base. Is this the end or is there hope? Lloyd Singleton.
So unfortunately, I think that dogwood is showing its last signs of life. In an urban setting, we find that the dogwoods typically do live 20, 25, 30 years, and then they kind of give up the ghost. Those sprouts near the base are kind of its last-ditch effort to photosynthesize, but I would say that it's probably on its way out, and we can look forward to replacing it with a new, young, healthy tree.
Okay. And I love that we have listeners who are so concerned about Nick's fig tree. I have another email about this. This is for you, Nick. This comes from Tracy McMullen, who says, regarding the fig tree, many other plants that seem to be declining or relatively stagnant in growth, check the mulch and soil around the trunk of the plant, as most landscape maintenance people and even homeowners often keep adding mulch every year without removing the old mulch. Old mulch will compost and turn into soil and suffocate the plant. So excess soil and mulch need to be removed from the sensitive fibrous top feeder roots. And Lloyd Singleton, that leads right into the tree suffocation question, which you have expressed concern about. You say that more people than not, even professional landscapers, tend to suffocate trees. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. I see it so commonly done around here where mulch is piled in a mound up around the trunk of a tree and is absolutely death to that tree, particularly young ones. What we need to do is, if you're going to mulch at the base of a tree, mulch around the edge of the root ball, but absolutely keep the mulch away from the trunk. You need to be able to see the visible root flare. In other words, the tree gets wider where it meets the soil level. If it doesn't get wider at the soil level, it was planted too deeply. And then that soil also needs to be removed. But basically, those roots need to be able to breathe. And so you must keep the soil and mulch away from the trunk of the tree, or it will die a slow, agonizing death.
And you have heard trees call out to you, and you've dropped to your knees and dug them out to give them oxygen.
I have. I call it guerrilla gardening.
So say that again. You need to be able to see the spread of the roots.
Yes, exactly. Think of an old tree, for example. It always has, the base of it is always broader. It's wider where that root meets the soil. So same thing with a young tree. You need to be able to see the roots getting wider as they enter the soil level. And many times you'll drive by and see parallel lines going into the ground or into that mulch. That means it's mulched or planted too deeply or mulched too high. And the rule of thumb is, do not let mulch touch the trunk. Keep it several inches away, and that will help with the survival of the tree.
It's our spring gardening show on Coastline today. We have two experts who can answer your questions during this live Wednesday discussion. And we have just a few minutes left in the show. Lloyd Singleton is director of the North Carolina Cooperative Extension, New Hanover County Center at the Arboretum. And Tom Erickson is co-owner of the Transplanted Garden, a garden supply store in downtown Wilmington, open by appointment only right now. You can ask your question by sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. And just a few minutes left for that. But I want to go back, Tom Erickson, to this idea of crepe myrtle, which you introduced us to several years ago on Coastline. And you, first of all, explain what this is, and then how are we doing with it? Are we murdering fewer crepe myrtles?
I think so. The term crepe myrtle, it's when you go in there and you just severely prune back to about the same location every year, usually in the late winter, early spring. Some of the landscapers will do it like in November because the lawns have stopped mowing and they're running out of projects. And it's just an ungodly looking, you know, way of treating a plant that wants to be a tree. There was all the crepe myrtles that go from somewhere right around Wrightsville Avenue where that comes out onto College all the way up to the north end of College where the overpass is. When I moved here, it's now 21 years ago, those trees were being pollard back. I mean, that's the term for it, to these big knuckles. I mean, they were just these, like, tumorous-looking growths at the end of the stems. And they would take and cut them back to, you know, say 12 or 15 feet every year. And now that this practice is lessened, these trees now, these same crepe myrtles, are now 25 or 30 feet or more tall, and they're providing the shade that they should be. So it was a way of making the blooms bigger on the plants, but I mean, the blooms would get so big that the branches would bend back down towards the ground, so you had this strange-looking Oompa Loompa kind of a tree or something. It looked like out of Dr. Seuss. With these big blooms pointing towards the ground rather than up into the air where they should be. And it's a lot more pleasing to look at the trees there along College, and it seems to be less and less of it happening around the area now. I'm sure some homeowners do still do it, but I'm hoping that the worst of the landscapers have, you know, got, majority of them have stopped doing this process because it's really awful to look at, especially all winter.
Yeah. And Lloyd Singleton, I want to make sure we get to hugelkultur. First of all, can you explain what that is?
Well, hugelkultur is basically hill growing. And the bottom line is you're going to improve the soil activity by having decomposition. And hugelkultur is basically where you have a bit of a trench that you fill with logs and sticks, and then you begin to cover that with other decomposing materials such as compost or hay or straw, and you build up the garden. So, and number one, it's easier to pick things because they're higher, but it actually really improves the soil microbiology because it's some active decomposition taking place. It's kind of an ancient technique, but one of the ideas is you don't just have to go till up your yard to have a garden. You can do things by building the soil up, building higher. It's actually better for the soil microbiology not to be disturbed by tilling.
And you've said, so tilling it disturbs the microbial activity, and we care about microbial activity in the soil because that's what helps the plants flourish. Is that the only reason we would care about that?
Well, it's a whole ecosystem, and it's very vital for the health of any kind of living organism, in particular the plants. It's the microbes that make the plant nutrients available. It's microbes that can actually sequester carbon. So there's a lot of benefit to keeping a healthy microbial activity in the soil, and you do that with the addition of organic matter and avoiding a lot of application of synthetics.
And you've said that people who don't have a backyard or don't have any kind of garden space, you can grow herbs and some plants in containers. You've also suggested just grabbing a bag of garden soil, slicing it open and sticking plants in that.
Absolutely. If you get a good soil blend, you can cut a couple of slits in the top of it, maybe poke a couple holes in the bottom to allow for drainage, and plant right in that bag of soil. Don't do a whole lot, maybe do two or possibly three plants in one bag of soil, but you can have a very self-contained, easy-to-grow garden. And I'd suggest doing something like a cherry tomato or maybe a squash plant.
And what about microgreens? We see them as garnishes on food at lovely restaurants, but what would a non-chef be doing with microgreens at home?
Well, if you grow microgreens at home, then number one, they're very easy to grow because it's a very short-term crop, so you don't have a whole lot of time to screw up before you harvest it. And you can harvest it with scissors, and you're just basically sprouting seeds and harvesting them when they have that first leaf developed. I love to use them on salads because it actually reduces the need for dressing because it has a nice flavor to it. For instance, radish microgreens are very spicy and add a great texture and flavor to salads. So it doesn't have to be a gourmet meal to enjoy microgreens.
Tom Erickson of the Transplanted Garden, we haven't really talked that much about pests here. Are there preventive measures that people can take to, say, protect their roses?
Yeah. The biggest problem with that is, you know, all getting rid of all the old fungal spores from the leaves from last year by getting all that cleaned up, raked up, get rid of the old mulch, and start a spray program. We've had some pretty good luck with just spraying our roses here with a copper soap-based fungicide, which is a lot less problematic, you know, for the environment. It's not more chemicals. It's just a straight copper. And that has worked quite well. It also works very well on hydrangeas that get mildew in the summertime and the leaf spot. And if you start it early in the season, I mean, as the buds are just starting to break and form, you know, the new growth buds, you can keep your plants a lot cleaner. If you wait until you start seeing a problem, getting problems, then it's really kind of a little too late. You're trying to push back something that's already gotten out of control. So if you start early in the season and keep up with it, that works out a lot better than waiting for a problem to come along, hoping that it won't. But in this climate, with roses, it's always going to happen.
Yeah.
And keeping them well fed, too.
Keep them well fed.
Keep them well fed. Stronger plants have less disease.
Okay. And we just have a minute or so left. Lloyd Singleton of the Cooperative Extension, the Soil and Water Conservation District, is also having a rain barrel sale. Is that right?
They sure are. They do that monthly and encourage people to just do a search engine search for New Hanover County Soil and Water Conservation District, and you can find the link to the information about picking up a curbside rain barrel.
And what is the advantage of using that to water our plants instead of just what we get out of the hose?
Well, number one, it's free. You don't have to pay for it. And number two, it doesn't have any additional chlorine. And chlorine can actually be slightly toxic to plants if it's applied at too high a concentration. So our drinking water is chlorinated, whereas rainwater is not. So capturing that rainwater is just efficient, and it's a good way to get your vegetables and houseplants watered.
Would you ever worry about the vessel that you're using to water a plant, say a tin or aluminum watering can, watering plants that you are then going to eat?
No, not if it's actually a bona fide watering vessel for plants. I don't see a problem, and I don't think you're going to allow the water to sit in it for too long. The rain barrels that the Soil and Water Conservation District offers are a food-grade plastic, so they're not going to be a problem either.
Okay. And Tom Erickson, what's the number one thing people can do to keep their plants healthy this year? I know you beat this drum all the time, but you have to remind people.
I mean, it's keeping them well tended to with fertilizer, keeping the plants thinned out, allowing good air circulation around the plants. I mean, by overcrowding, you're going to come up with more disease problems. It's going to make it easier for insects to spread, all that sort of a thing. So just, you know, keep them well fed and happy.
Great. And that's this edition of Coastline. Tom Erickson of the Transplanted Garden, Lloyd Singleton of the Cooperative Extension, thank you both so much for being with us today.
Our pleasure.
Anytime. And everybody stay safe.
Coastline's production team is led by Rachel Keith and includes Ken Campbell, Doc Jardin, and Marissa Castrino. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org, get the podcast, or find it on the HQR app. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.